Okay, we are in week four, if you open your workbooks, up to week four. We started, week four is over, covers verses 15 through 23 of chapter 1. He entitles it the Christ Hymn. The Christ Hymn is actually verses 15 through 20, but he takes, in verses 21 through 23, he takes the Christ Hymn and applies it to the Colossians. So that's why they're lumped together. Now, there weren't very many of us last week. So just very quick review. The reason verses 15 through 20 is referred to as a hymn or a poem. I mean, there's debate whether it's a hymn or not. But the reason that there is debate, the reason that many scholars refer to it either as a hymn or a poem, is because Paul changes his style dramatically in these verses, starting in verse 15. We already saw in week two what Paul sharing with the Colossians what he was thankful with them, thankful to God about them, verses 9 through 14. That's one long, complicated sentence. And I mean 3 through 8, one long, complicated sentence. Paul telling them what he's thankful to God about them. And then in verses 9 through 14, he told them what he's praying specifically for them about. And again, that's one long, complicated sentence. Then all of a sudden, in verse 15, he starts writing in these short, succinct sentences. You can see it in the Greek. It's a dramatic change in his style. And by verses 19 and 20, he's back to his old ways. You know, long, complicated sentences. Verse 21 through 23 is one long, complicated sentence. Or at least 22 and 23 is. So anyway, that's the reason it's called a hymn. So just wanted you to know that. And last week we talked about why Paul would, and there's debate whether or not Paul wrote it or whether he's quoting it. I think he wrote it. Many scholars think he wrote it, or at least that if he did borrow it, that he heavily modified it. But anyway, I think he wrote it. And we discussed last week why he put that hymn there. Why did he do that? You know, verses 3 through 8, he's telling them, you know, hi, Colossians, greeting Colossians, verses 1 and 2. 3 through 8 is, this is what I thank God about you. Verses 9 through 14, this is what I'm asking God specifically about you. Starting in verse 24, all the way through verse 5 of chapter 2, he's telling them, and this is what I'm doing on your behalf. So why in verses 15 through 23 did he stick this poem or this hymn? Why did he do that? What was the point of it? And those of you who were here last week, we talked about three things in particular. Do you remember some of those things? Yes, it's, remember in verse 14, he says he transferred you out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his dear son. So in verses 15 through 20, he's answering the question, and who is this person, this dear son, into whose kingdom that you've been transferred? So he's doing that. Yes. I'm sorry. Thank you for that. Yes. What Pam said is he shared it. He wrote this so that we would, say it again, Pam. To make much of Christ at the very beginning of the letter. And in making much of him, answering specifically, who is this guy into whose kingdom you've been transferred? Who is this man? And like I said, I think you can see that in chapter 2. If you switch over to chapter 2 real fast. What I have in mind is the second half of verse 2 and all of verse 3, but start in verse 1 of chapter 2. For I want you to know how great a struggle I have for you and for those at Laodicea and for those who have not seen me face to face, that their hearts may be encouraged, being knitted together in love, to reach all the riches of full assurance of understanding and the knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And so that's what Pam is saying. 15 through 20, he's laying this, he's making much of Christ. He's laying these two big images of Christ out there for us in this poem in verses 15 through 20. And back in chapter 1, verse 9, Paul told him, and so from the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you, asking that you may be filled with the full knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding. And I maintain that the knowledge of his will there is the knowledge of his revealed will, and in particular, his revealed will in Christ, what he's doing in and through Christ, the mystery of Christ that Paul refers to in chapter 2. So that's one of the things he's doing. Is he is fleshing out for them who this person is and what knowledge he wants us to be filled with all spiritual wisdom and understanding. That is the knowledge of God's revelation in Jesus Christ, the mystery of Christ. Okay, that's one thing. Another reason, why did he do it here? Yes, yes. Right, for memory and worship. And we talked about that, didn't we? How songs, one of the powerful things about songs and poems is it's put down in language that affects your emotions. It pulls the emotions out of you, and it puts these truths in short, succinct statements that are easy to remember and evokes emotion out of you, and so you remember them. And these are truths that you can use that we use to worship God. So that's the reason he didn't just say, okay, use one big long extended sentence to say, okay, here's the guys whose kingdom you've been transferred into, is because he wants to facilitate our remembering it and using it to worship him. So he puts these two pictures of Christ in poetic fashion, in like a hymn. That's why he changed his style dramatically right there, and only there, is to facilitate our memory and our worship, putting it in a hymn. And then one third thing that we talked about why he put it there. You remember? Absolutely. He is building, in this hymn, he is building an armory. And in chapter 2, he's going to use all the ammunition in that armory against the false teachers and false teaching. So when we go through chapter 2, you're going to see that he's going to be revisiting much of this truth that he shares in verses 15 through 20 about Christ. Okay? So that's why it's there. It may seem odd at first, but when you think about it, okay, that is a real strategic location and a real strategic way to handle that. Okay. Now, the two stanzas are this. One starts at the beginning of verse 15 and the other starts at the middle of 18. In verse 15, he says, image of God, firstborn of creation. If it's much easier to see in the Greek. So he's talking about his son that he mentioned in verse 14. And he starts off verse 15, who is image of God, firstborn of creation. And then he says some stuff about that. And then in the middle of verse 18, he says, who is beginning, firstborn from the dead. That's the way the two stanzas start. So the first stanza is about him as supreme, one of first rank, supreme over all creation, talking about original creation. The second stanza we're going to see tonight, him being the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, is him being the first and the initiator of the new creation. So that first stanza, that first image, or that first picture of Christ being the image of God, firstborn of creation, has to do with his relation to the original creation. And that second picture of him being the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, has to do with his relation to the new creation. Okay, those are the two stanzas. Verse 17 and the first half of 8 is kind of like a transition state stanza, a bridge. We just had one of those. We just had those, one of those in the song that we sang tonight. Now my debt is paid, it is paid in full. If you look at the thing, it says, this is a bridge. This is a transition. That's what verse 17 and the first half of verse 18 is. It's three similar statements about Christ. It says he is before all things. He holds all things together. And he is the head of the body, the church. That first short statement there, he is before all things, looks back to the first stanza. He is of first rank in creation, in the original creation, supreme overall. That third statement, he is the head of the church. He is the head of the body, the church, looks forward to the second stanza. It's his relationship to the new creation, the result of him being the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, is that he is the head of the body, the church. That middle statement right there at the end of verse 17, he holds all things together, looks both directions. He holds everything together in the original creation and in the new creation. So right there, that second statement there in verse 17 is kind of the center, the fulcrum of the hymn. He holds everything together. How is that? Because, first stanza, he is the image of God, firstborn of creation. And second stanza, also because he is the beginning, the firstborn of the dead. And that is why he holds one of the implications of that, of those two pictures, is he holds everything together. All right? That's kind of the structure of the song. that may only excite people like me who love that kind of stuff. It speaks to me. But I like math. I love math. I love graphical things like that. So anyway, hopefully more than me was happy with that. Or were happy with that. I like grammar too. Okay. Now in this, we saw in this first picture that he is the image of God, the firstborn from the dead. The image of God is what? What did we say that implies about Christ? Do you guys remember? I'm talking to the five that were here last week. And one of them's not. Exactly. He is the exact representation of God's nature. Hebrews 1:3. And remember in John 14, Thomas said, Lord, just show us the Father and we'll be satisfied. Thomas, you've been with me so long and you don't know to see me is to see the Father? So the question is, how are we to see, since God's invisible, remember he says he's the image of the invisible God. Since God's invisible, how is he to be seen? And the answer to the question is in the Son, in Christ. Because he, in fleshed, is the exact replication, representation of God's nature. And so the first stanza says, who is this Son into whose kingdom you've been transferred? Well, he is the image of God, the firstborn of creation. Now, we said last week, this word firstborn, because we're going to look at it with this second picture. We didn't cover the second picture last week. We only got through verses 15 and 16 last week. Remember we said that word firstborn, prototokos, this is the Greek. That word firstborn can mean either first in a series, first in time, or first in rank. And we said, we ask the question, how do we know which way Paul is using this? He is the image of the invisible God, firstborn of the creation. Okay, if it's first in time or first in the series, that means he's the first one created. And as a matter of fact, Arius, from whom Jehovah Witnesses get their heresy about the person, about Jesus being a little God, a created God. They got that from the fourth century heretic Arius. This is one of the verses that Arius goes to. See, he is the firstborn of creation. He's the first one created. So how do we know that Arius isn't right? Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear what Joe said? Because other scriptures tell us that Jesus is the one that the Son, the eternal Son, not Jesus, the eternal Son, who later became Jesus when he took on a human nature, but the eternal Son created the universe. So, you know, think about this. To qualify as being created, you have to first not exist, right? But then to do the creating, you have to exist. So Jesus couldn't have created himself. That means he would have to not exist and exist at the exact same time. And yet, John 1:3 says that there was nothing that was created that was not created through or by the Word, that is Jesus, the eternal Son. Okay? So clearly he wasn't created. But I want to encourage you just to look at the context. Because in words like firstborn that have different ways you can go with it, what's going to determine what the author really means is the context. Now, can we see from verses 15, 16, and 17 whether or not he means that he was the first one created by firstborn from creation? Can we see that? Yes. Right. For in him, yeah, I know. Yeah. That word by can also be translated in. For in him, or with reference to him, all things were created. In heaven, on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones, dominions, or rulers. But then you look at that next phrase there at the end of verse 16. All things were created through him. There's no ambiguity there. That is not open to debate. Yes. Right. I would use the verse at the end there. Through him. All things were created by through him. So clearly, Paul's not saying he's the firstborn of creation. That is, he's the first one created because all things were created through him. Paul's not a dummy. He wouldn't say something that he wouldn't contradict himself like that. Do you see how that's contradictory? Oh, Jesus is the firstborn from the eternal Son is the firstborn from creation. He's the first one. He is the first one created because all things were created through him. No, if he's the first one created, not all things were created by him. He's the big exception, right? And if you talk to Jehovah's Witnesses, like if you share John 1 with Jehovah's Witnesses and you take them to verse 3 and show them all things were created through the Word, that is through the Son. All things were created through him, and nothing that was created, and there was nothing that was created that was not created by him. Because I've taken them to that verse many times. They pause, they look at it, and then they look up at me and said, "Oh, but he means everything but Jesus." And obviously my response is, "But that's not what he says." He says, there's nothing that was created that was not created through the Word. That's what he says. You're disagreeing with him. You're saying something different. You're saying, no, John, don't get, you know, too excited here. What he was created first and then he created everything. So, but again, so what I'm saying is this. Firstborn could mean first in a series, or, you know, like first in time, or first in rank. But he says he's firstborn of creation. All things were created through him. Clearly, he is not using it in the sense of first in a series. Jesus was not, the Son was not the first one created. That's not how he's using firstborn there. Because right in the same verse, or right in the very next verse, he says he was the creator. So he cannot be the created and the creator at the same time, okay? So that means firstborn is being used there to mean first in rank, not first in a series. He is the image of the invisible God supreme over everyone else, everything and every other being. He is first in rank over everyone and everything, every being and everything. And why is he first in rank? Because, and this is where those prepositions come in, through, and unto. He is supreme because all of creation, everything was created with reference to him. I would say in him instead of by him. I would translate it that way. In him instead of by him. And what he means by in him means that everything was created with reference to him. And then at the end of verse 16, through him all things were created, and unto or for him tells you how all things were created with reference to him. He, at the beginning of creation, he was there as the creator, as the originator, as the origin of creation. Through him, all things were created. So at the beginning of the universe, he was there as its origin. Then at the end of the universe, he is there as its goal. Everything points to him. Everything's going to be summed up in him. So you see that? He is the image of God, the express, this first picture of him in this hymn. He is the express nature. He is the image of God, the one who is has the exact representation of God's nature, supreme in the universe, of first rank in the universe. Why? Because the whole universe was created with respect to him. He stands at its beginning as its origin, its creator. He stands at the end of it as its goal, what everything is flowing to. Okay, does that make sense? Now, in this second picture, which that puts us page 30. And see, here's where I differ just a tad bit from the author. Do you see on page 30, number 2, the Christ hymn, the Son's preeminence over the new creation? He's going into the second stanza, and he says, and he's treating the transition. He's treating the next picture of him as the head of the body of the church, that's where the second stanza begins. And I don't think so. It's because of the way it is in the Greek. But there's many Greek scholars that hold the same thing that he does, that it starts there. So let me start with the very next question, where he says, in 118b, Paul explains that the Son is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. That's where that second stanza begins. The first stanza, the picture is, he is the image of the invisible God, supreme in the universe, firstborn from creation. Second stanza, he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. So this author writes, the language echoes Genesis 1:1 and conveys the reality that Christ's resurrection signals the inauguration or beginning. Scholars like to use big words. Whenever you see the word inauguration, just substitute beginning, okay? It signals the beginning of the promised new creation. Then he asks this question, how does the idea of the new creation fit into your current ideas of what heaven will be like. Anybody put anything down there for that? Yeah. That's your understanding, and so that would fit with it, right? He said, Seth said, it would be like a reboot. Everything is set right. Sin's no longer there. It's the presence of sin is gone. All of creation has been renovated, and so it's like a reboot.
My question was whether I was looking through the cross references.
Yes.
And I agree with what Seth's saying, and then my current view is also that so often we picture heaven as being clouds and sparks
and I think that's what he's getting at. I think it's imagery for length of life, longevity. And obviously.
Because there's another verse that says that there will be no more death, no more crying.
Right. Right. So in the present life, there's lots of infant death. In the present life, before our modern medical technology, we were only living 50, 60, 70 years. I mean, 50, 60 years. Modern medical technology has been able to extend that a couple of decades. So in other words, shortness of life. For instance, how long did Methuselah live? 969, exactly. And that wasn't because he was using... a special low count months in order to come up with 969 years. What was that? Yeah. Wes said because they were on the whole 30 diet. But people might like to know what we're laughing at. I think that's what it.
Okay,
but here's what I think. Here's one of the things that I think he's probably trying to get you to see in those Old Testament references is the new earth, the images from earth, not clouds and harps and all of that, but also because when you see in Revelation 21, he says, "Look at this for a minute." So we're probably going to go third week on week four, but look at this in Revelation 21. Starting in verse 1, the Apostle John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning nor crying, nor pain anymore, for former things have passed away.'" That down in, drop down in verse 7, "The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is indeed the second death." What seems to be happening here is the New Jerusalem's coming down, and now all of a sudden, the new heaven and the new earth are all incorporated into the New Jerusalem. Because he starts off talking about the new heavens and the new earth, and then he goes to the New Jerusalem. And verse 8 tells us who's excluded, and the clear implication of that is they're excluded from the new heavens and earth as well as the New Jerusalem. The clear implication is the New Jerusalem has encompassed everything. It's the temple of, I've only started that book, Temple of God. But one guy, Gregory Beale, has written, or J.K. Beale, or whatever his name is. Greg, okay, I was right the first time. Greg Beale's written a biblical theology on the temple of God. But that's a point that tends to get skipped over in Revelation. How here's one of two extremes we go with heaven. We either make it just clouds and harps and all of that sort of thing, or the new faddish thing is to zero in on new heaven and new earth and make it mostly new earth. And so they say that you're doing now what you're going to do in the new earth. That's the importance of what you're doing. They say it's not about who you are, it's about what you do. But that's not what I read in the Bible. It's about who you are. And yes, what you do is important. And what you do right now, you're contributing to the kingdom of heaven. But it is important who you are. You are a saint. You are a worshiper of God. See, those that say that concentrate on the new earth and say it's all about what you're doing now, that's just going to continue on. What they shrink away from is making heaven a continual worship service. But the picture there in Revelation 21 is the temple of God, the city of God, temple of God comes and consumes the entire heaven and earth. The whole heaven and earth is a temple of God. Yes, it is about who you are. You are a worshiper of God. And yes, all of eternity, we will be worshiping God. So I think that's what he's trying to do, is trying to just get us to see that it's not just all clouds and harps, that is a misconception of heaven, that heaven entails, heaven's going to incorporate the new heavens and new earth, and it's all going to be the temple of God. We will be worshiping God because we've been transformed into those that love God and worship him. And everything about who we are and what we do is worship of God. That's the picture of him. I think that's what he's trying to get you to see there.
And we don't become angels.
We don't become angels. No, we do not become angels. Yes. I know. I know, as fun as, oh, what's that Christmas? It's a Wonderful Life. As fun as that Jimmy Stewart movie is, Clarence is not a reality, okay? And every time you hear a bell ring does not mean an angel just got their wings, okay? Say that again. Oh, Seth said his last name was Oddbody. How is that funny? Yeah, yes, the whole concept is odd, yes. So, but I do want to concentrate a little bit more on this firstborn of the dead, because this is the beginning of that second stanza. This is the second big, huge picture that Paul wants us to get of Christ. And that is, he is the beginning, the firstborn of the dead. Now again, this word firstborn can mean what? First in the series or time? First in rank, right? How do we know which of those meanings Paul intends? Where do we get our clues? From our doctrinal statement or from the text, the context? What's the very next statement? Yes, but in this case, did Christ die? Notice in verse 19, I'm verse 20. And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. So clearly, he has got him being the firstborn from the dead. He's got in view his resurrection from the dead, because he refers to his death. He refers to what Christ did in his death. He reconciled us. So, in this second stanza, he is the beginning, the firstborn of the dead, means that he is the first one to resurrect from the dead. Okay? Now, you may object. You may say, well, what about Lazarus? Didn't he resurrect from the dead? No. I think a better term is Christ miraculously resuscitated him. Because the clear implication is he died again. Okay? But here's the thing that I want you to see. He's the first in a series. You know what that means? He initiated this whole series of resurrections. He was the first one, and he initiated this whole series. And believers are swept up into that series. You know, I know people get excited about the World Series. And you love it when your team is in the World Series. But let me tell you, this is the series that you want to be in. The series that Jesus initiated, being the firstborn from the dead. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I'm going to read verses 20 to 23. Paul writes this. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 through 23. Paul writes this. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For as by a man came death, by a man has come also resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ all shall be made alive, but each in his own order. Christ the first fruits, then at his coming, those who belong to Christ. So that's 1 Corinthians 15, 20 to 23 is a good explanation of what Paul is talking about Christ being the firstborn from the dead. He initiated this whole series of resurrection from the dead. He was the first one, and he initiated this whole series of being resurrected from the dead. So, yes, Wes, I mean, Seth, you have a question all over your face.
So this comes down to our definition, then, of resurrection from the dead, because clearly we're not going to say that Lazarus didn't die, or there's, you know, there's even miraculous resurrections. I hesitate to use that word.
Now, right.
In the Old Testament, you know, the prophets falling on the son of the widow and so on and so forth, and he was, you know, was dead, raised to life. So that's what this is coming down to, then.
Yes.
Defining what we mean. That it just, 3 minutes ago, it just sounded odd to say that Lazarus didn't die, that he was miraculously resuscitated.
No, I didn't say he didn't die.
Or that he wasn't raised from the dead.
I said he wasn't resurrected.
Okay, so that's what I mean. So be clear on what we mean by that.
Right. And so, I saw Wes's hand, but so, for the tape, what Seth said, it sounds like for the record, what Seth said, what he asked, he says, so this is coming down to our definition of resurrection, right? Because Lazarus did die, and then he did come back from that death. He came back alive from that death. So to say that Christ was the firstborn from the dead, the first in the series of resurrections, is to boil down to our definition of resurrection. And I said yes to that. And before I comment further on that, bingo, Bob, that's exactly what I was going to explain. Here's... yeah. What Wes pointed out was that when Lazarus was brought back from the dead, he was brought back in his old physical body. Right? His body was made alive again. What happens to believers who what's going to happen at the resurrection when Christ... New bodies. Yes. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, we shall be changed. And he's not talking about the nursery there. He is talking about our bodies being transformed into glorified bodies, okay? Now, what about saints who die and go be with the Lord before Christ's return, before we get our new glorified bodies? What's their existence like? Are they like Lazarus, only walking around in heaven? Do they have a physical body in heaven? It's not a trick question. The answer is no. Thank you. They do not have a physical body. Matter of fact, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul refers to them as disembodied people.
Like
not zombies, but they're at when Christ, when the resurrection of all the saints happen, their physical bodies are going to be brought back to life and transformed immediately. Okay? And so that's what we're talking about as far as the resurrection. Okay. Okay, Joe's going to ask us about something that she didn't know she didn't understand until right now.
Or he was the first one resurrected. So then where are the, you know, what's their situation? Then I thought, well, then I guess that's where the walking around the clouds and the angels, and that's kind of where that imagery could come from. But I don't know that I understood what you said. Okay, what's the explanation? Where are they? Yes, when he comes back, they'll get that new body. But in the meantime...
Believers right now, remember... Paul said to be absent from the body is to be present from the Lord. But they're present with him without a glorified body.
Whether they die before or...
Well, you mean before or after Christ's first coming?
Before or after Christ was resurrected.
Yeah, before Christ, you know, there's debate.
That's
as normal. You know, they were probably in... you know, many, I haven't made up my mind about that yet, but many hold in, is it Luke 19? Yeah, or Luke 16, one of those two chapters, yeah, Abraham's bosom, yeah. Yeah, Lazarus and the rich man, they're in comfort, whether they're in the presence of the Lord. Now, this is all before the first coming of Christ and his death and resurrection. Whether or not they were in his presence, in the Lord's presence, there's debate over that, and I haven't made up my mind because I haven't gotten around to restudying it again. Okay? There's a lot of good people that say, no, they were in the presence of the Lord. Yeah. Right. But with him, because that then Christ died and rose again. So. But clearly, that's one thing that I've come to, I've heard enough from good men, from good Bible teachers, men or women, that argue that, no, they were Old Testament saints, were in the presence of God. Also, that I've got to restudy that. I just haven't gotten around to doing it. But now, since Christ's death and resurrection, all saints are in the very presence of God, but without their glorified bodies. Which, yeah, or after the millennium. It really depends on where you stand on that. But at the end of the age, okay, we'll put it that way. At the end of the age. That's why we say that Lazarus was not resurrected. Now, Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life in John 11 there. He was brought back from the dead by the power of God, the power of God that gives us resurrection life. We live resurrection life now. We're going to see that in Romans chapter 6. We live in newness of life. That's resurrection life. But we have not experienced resurrection yet. And the first reason is because all of you that I'm talking to, you haven't experienced death yet. Of course, there is a generation that's not going to experience death, isn't there? That their bodies will just be instantly transformed, glorified. That's right. That's right. Yeah. I won't go there. There's so many jokes been made over the years about the dead in Christ shall rise first. Anyway, so what I want you to see in this second stanza is this big, huge picture of Christ as the beginning, in the sense that he is the firstborn from the dead. He is the one who initiates the resurrection. And so we'll look at those verses. We'll finish up this section next week.